Hello, everybody. Welcome to already the ninth lecture of our machine learning course. And this time, the lecture is being recorded in Prague. First, are there any questions regarding to anything, theory, assignments, whatever, on your part? Doesn't seem there are any questions, but don't hesitate to ask or add them to chat or something if you want to. So I talked about the possibility of having some kind of an Q&A session for the students who would like to ask about some solutions or theory problems or assignments, whatever they want. So I have decided it will take place tomorrow, and there is an ongoing voting on Piazza, which will decide when it will be held. So if you don't know about it, you can go there and vote. If you don't want to go there, then of course you don't have to care. I looked before the lecture, and it seemed the time slot at 2 p.m. was the current best so far. We will see how it goes and if it makes sense to do this on a more regular basis. Yeah, so it means I have done all these things and there are no questions. So let's start with the lecture. Today we will talk about model combinations, how to combine more models together, even if we have done this already in some of the assignments, probably. And also about a model which is called decision trees. You probably have heard something about decision trees already. So that must not be really missed from any introductory course to machine learning. So let's get started. First, we need to talk about covariance and correlation, which are terms which we won't use that much today, but we will start hitting them in the next lecture. So let's take some time to really understand them. Given a collection of random variables, we know that the expectation of the sum of the random variables is exactly the sum of the expectation of the random variables. In other words, the expectation is a linear operator. But how about the variance of the sum of these random variables? We would also like to know what it is. And when we are analyzing the combination of several models, we will need to get a bound on this value. However, it's not it's not so easy as with the expectation because of the square in the definition of the variance. So the variance of the sum of the random variables is the expectation of the difference between the variable itself, so the sum of the variables, minus the expectation of the sum of the variables, and that's the sum of the expectation, we already know it. So now we can pair the corresponding random variables together, so this variance is the expectation of some of these differences. Each difference is xi minus the corresponding expectation. And this is there. There is a square here. So when we get rid of this square, this one sum became two sums, right? One over I, the other over j. We have the xi minus the expectation of xi. And then this second factor, which is xi minus the expectation of xj. Now we already have the sum, the expectation of some sum, so we can swap again. And we get that the variance of the sum of the random variable is actually a lot of expectations, where all pairs of xi and xj are together. And what we are looking at is the something similar to what is there in variance, and that's the difference between xi and the mean xi and xj and the mean xj. And this value we will define to be the covariance of two random variables. So for x and y, we will say that the covariance is the expectation of x minus expectation of x times y minus expectation of y. Such So what does this value actually tells us, right? It seems like a weird number. We have defined it so that we know that the variance of the sum of the random variables is actually this value. So a lot of covariances, that's nice, but that's not much. So first thing to note is the covariance for the same random variable with itself is just a variance, right? So it's some kind of a generalization of a variance. And we can also rewrite it like this. The covariance of two random variables is the expectation of the product of these variables minus the product of the expectations. That probably doesn't help you much in realizing what it does, but we will get there. To prove this, it's really a trivial thing. We just get rid of the parentheses. We get four terms, and now all the ones with the expectations can be considered constant. So they we can like say this is an expectation of four terms. So it's the expectation of the individual terms, and three of them. The last three will be the expectation of X times the expectation of Y. So some of them will cancel. For example, these two one can cancel and only one will be left there. You have probably heard the term correlated or uncorrelated, and that's actually very much connected to covariance, meaning that two variables are said to be uncorrelated if they have a covariance of zero, or otherwise they are correlated if they have some non-zero covariance, right? So this covariance thing somehow contain the information about correlation of the random two variables. Now, if the random variables are independent, then they are uncorrelated. That's from the like vague definitions of the terms that probably make sense. And it also is true in the mathematical sense. In order to prove it, proving it is not that difficult. It seems that there is a lot of lines, but the main idea is simple. So let's look at the covariance, which means this expectation. This expectation is, in the discrete case, just a sum. In the continuous case, the sum would need to be replaced by an integral, but other than that, it would be the proof would be the same. So let's just go with the discrete one. And this expectation goes over all pairs of X and Y. And what we are summing is the probability of this pair. There's like a joint probability of these two values of the random variables times the value of the covariance, right? And now the important thing comes, if they are independent, then this probability can be factorized into the probability of X, and then the probability of Y, right? And when this happens, we can split them apart and then compute this as one sum and another independent sum. And these sums are just expectations. So this is the expectation of X for X minus expectation of X, and this is for Y minus expectation of Y. So being independent means we can actually evaluate these parts independently, and each part independently is zero, right? Because the expectation of X minus EX, that's the expectation of X minus expectation of X, and that's just zero. The same for Y, and we get zero. So really independent variables are uncorrelated. However, the other way around is not true. So being uncorrelated doesn't mean that the random variables are independent. For example, even a very simple case where we have a random variable X, which is uniform on this minus one, one range, and Y, which takes the absolute value of X, right? So it looks like this. And then these two random variables are definitely not independent, because y is actually fully defined by the value of x, right? And even if you just see y, there are only two possible values of x which could occur at the same time. However, their correlation is zero, right? That's because if you look at this sum, then the values for I do not depend on the sign, while the values for X do depend on the sign. So the sum for X from 0 to 1 has exactly the opposite value as this sum from minus 1 to 0 for X, right? So they will cancel out and they will be uncorrelated. So what does this correlation mean in more detail? Just having like correlated or uncorrelated variables, that would be too little. So instead, we want actually to also measure the degree to which two variables are correlated. And for that, there are several measures, but the basic one is the Pearson correlation coefficient. It's denoted by two different letters depending on the way how we actually compute it. So the raw value is really computed from the definition using the expectations. And what is the value is the covariance of x and y divided by the square root of the variance of the first random variable and the square root of variable variance of the second random variable. So if we had a notion for standard deviation, well, we didn't officially define it, but if we had it, right, we could say it like this, covariance divided by two standard deviations. If we are in fact estimating the correlation coefficient from data, so we estimate the covariance by really using the point estimates of the expectations and the same for the variances, then it's denoted usually as R. And these two coefficients have different names. So the first one is the population coefficient, and the second is the sample coefficient. In Czech, the second one is výběrový, and I'm not sure about the first one, but I would say population makes sense probably. Yep. When we are computing the estimate of variance, there is this 1 over n minus 1 thing, right, which seems to be missing. But we actually have the same coefficient up here, 1 over n minus 1. And these actually cancel each other out, so we don't need to compute really the averages, because it will be just, it will just cancel by itself. This definition is in fact like a normalized version of the covariance. So the correlation coefficient just tells us what the covariance is, but it's normalized so that the value lies between minus 1 and 1. To see that the value really lies between this minus 1 and 1 range, we will need a Cauchy-Schwarz, or Schwarz, I don't know how it's in English, inequality. This inequality tells us that in any space with a scalar product, we know that the value of the scalar product of u and v is limited by the length of u times length of v, where the length is measured by the square root of the scalar product with itself. Right, this is an inequality which you probably have seen. It's the one which is being used also to define like the angle between vectors in high dimensional space, right? Because we know that this holds, then this is sometimes being used to define the cosine of that angle between two vectors is exactly the ratio, right? U v divided by this. Yep. So if we use the expectation as a way to compute the scalar product, right? If we say that the scalar product of x and y is the expectation of x times y, then using this yields exactly the result that this is bounded by 1 and minus 1, right? When we, it kind of makes intuitive sense. Here we have the expectation of x minus, let's say x bar, and here is y minus y bar. And here we have the square root of expectation of x minus x bar squared. And the second one here as well, y minus y bar squared. Then we are computing the product of two numbers. And here in the denominator, we are always multiplying the number by itself and the second number by itself, right? So the whatever one is larger, then hopefully this part will be large enough so that these two numbers all together will be larger than combining them independently. And the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality actually proves that it's so. So the covariance, if we normalize it, describes this correlation between random variables, and this correlation actually evaluates the amount of linear dependence between these two variables, right? So it's not general dependence, but just linear dependence. There are many examples copied from Wikipedia, which shows you how it actually works. So if the correlation coefficient is minus 1, then it means that the data from the x and y random variables, they actually form a straight line with a negative slope, right? So for example, in this case, where whenever x increases, y decreases, and they are really on one line. So they are completely linearly dependent. If the values are generally, like the value of y is decreasing whenever x is increasing, but it's not on a line, but with some kind of an error, then the coefficient is not exactly minus 1, but something like minus 0.8 or something. And the larger the noise, the larger the difference is, the smaller the coefficient is. And if there is no linear correlation between these two random variables, then we have the uncorrelated. So if there is no linear dependence, then we have the uncorrelation. And then it goes up once again. Plus 1 means it's an ideal line, this time with positive slope, so it increases. And something between 0 and 1 generally means that the second increases whenever the first one increases. Right? That's what this formula does. Like, if this x is larger than the average, then we are measuring whether also y is larger than the average, right? So if the x increases and y increases, then this value will be large positive value. And if it's like a perfectly linear, then it will be exactly 1. The angle or the slope of the dependence doesn't really matter. So whenever it's increasing, it's 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. When it's decreasing, it's minus 1, minus 1. Here, it's not really defined because the variance of y is 0. So the definition is just doesn't allow us to do the normalization. If the data are a bit more noisy, the more noisy they are, the less correlated the values are, and so on and so on. However, as you can see from this third line, this coefficient only quantifies linear dependence, right? There are a lot of obviously dependent random variables here, but they all have a correlation of 0. Including the warbird of Klingons, is just uncorrelated random variables. So that's what the covariance is, unnormalized a correlation. So it somehow tells us whether we should expect the random value y to increase if x increases or decrease if x decreases or not. Generally, the covariance is just one number, or the correlation is just one number. So similarly to means and variances, they tell you something about the distribution, but of course, a lot of distributions can have these parameters, and this is a often cited example of four distributions which look quite different, each of them, but they all have the same mean, variance, the same correlation, and the same regression line. But that's how it is. If you describe distribution with a lot of numbers using just small number of parameters, then of course these things will just happen. Know that the linear correlation might not be enough in many cases. In many cases, we would generally just be intrigued in whether when the value of one variable increases, whether the second one increases as well. So we would also like to quantify the non-linear correlation, right? So just when we touch the subject, let's just say the definition. So there are two frequently used non-linear correlation coefficients. One is the Spearman's rank correlation coefficient, which is also denoted as rho. And how it works? Well, we take the original data, and then instead of working with the values of the original data, we will use their ranks, right? So the smallest value gets rank one, the second smallest gets rank two, three, four, and so on till the largest value gets rank of n, where n is the number of data. So we do this, we replace the values by the ranks, and then we just compute the previous person correlation coefficient. This way, we don't really care about the value of the data, we only care about their ordering, right? So this example here on the left side has a correlation of one, because you can see that y always increases whenever x increases. However, when thinking about the linear correlation, it's not really perfectly correlated. So the person correlation coefficient is 0.88, while this Spearman is 1. Otherwise, it generally behaves similar to the Pearson coefficient. Well, it's defined using it, so it's not really surprising. So generally, if it seems that y increases with x, we get a high value close to one. If it decreases, we get some value close to minus one. And if it seems like there is not much correlation, it will be somewhere near zero. So that's one nonlinear coefficient. And the second one is the Kendall rank correlation coefficient. That's usually denoted as tau. And it works on a very similar principle. It can actually be shown that both of these coefficients are instances of one common general coefficient, but it's similar in a way that it only cares about ordering, right? But instead of using this Pearson correlation coefficient, which might be tricky to see what's actually happening when this is combined with ranks, then the tau, the Kendall tau, looks directly at the pairs of values, right? So whenever it sees xi and xj, it looks at the y's, right? So let's look at yi. Generally, what can happen, either we have yj, which is larger than yi, or we can have yj, which will be smaller than yi, like this. And the idea is that the above case means they are like positively correlated, it really increases, they both increase, while this would be like negatively correlated, so whenever x increases, y decreases. So in the Kendall tau coefficient, we explicitly compute the number of such pairs where the y's increase, a number of pairs where y decreases. I am just ignoring the fact that the values can be the same. And I will just divide this by the number of all possible pairs so that we keep the coefficient in the one minus minus one to one range, right, like this. So both these nonlinear coefficients look at the ordering of the value instead of at the ranks. However, the linear one just looks at the linear dependence. So now let's actually utilize it for something. And we will use our new definitions to somehow analyze the performance of some model combination. So model combination and has a lot of different names, but one of them is also ensembling. And I would say that nowadays in the papers about complex machine learning models, that's the most frequently used term. So ensembling is a way of combining multiple models on the same task in order to reach higher performance, to improve the performance. And if we say that we use multiple models, we must somehow decide how we will actually combine the results together, right? For regression, it should be fine. We will just compute the averages. However, for classification, there are several, or I would say two major ways how we can do it. And unfortunately, the terminology isn't really stable or fixed. But generally, when we say voting, I mean really like raising your hands, right? So sometimes it's called hard voting, but if you have some number of models, like in the individual classifiers in the multi-class SVM, then each of them just raises a hand for one of the outcomes, and whatever outcome has the higher number of votes, then it wins. And if there is a tie, then we just need to arbitrarily decide who wins. Alternatively, we could use averaging. So if the models gave not just the prediction of the class, but probabilities, the distribution of outcomes, we could just compute the average, right? Whenever we have an MLP, we know that it generates a categorical distribution, and we can really average them because they are nice and smooth. So in this case of averaging and sometimes soft voting, we predict the outcome which has the highest probability after the average. This time, usually, there are no ties because the probability of getting ties is very low, has very little probability. And it can extract more information from the models than just the predicted classes. If one model says, okay, I think it's a cat, but it also may be a dog, but I prefer cat. Like, it's always like 50-50, but the cat wins a bit. While there could be another model and this is a dog, it's definitely a dog. Then with voting, it would be a tie and we would just choose arbitrarily. However, in averaging, the dog will probably have a higher probability because it has quite a good probability from the first model, and then the second model was like all four for it, right? So this way we learn something from the first model, like how sure it is about its predictions. So that's one thing, how to combine these models. And then why it should actually work, right? And the idea is that if we consider the models to we can look at the predictions of the individual models by predicting like the gold, the real expected output, the target, plus some kind of a noise, right? Some errors, some mistakes, some misclassifications. And because we have multiple models, then each has got its own error vector or noise vectors. Now, if these errors would be uncorrelated, our new term, right? So if it would be uncorrelated, then averaging the output should just make the errors disappear, naively said, right? Averaging the output should mean that the errors should cancel out, and they will cancel out exactly in the case where they are uncorrelated, right? Because if there is an error and the same error for a different model, then that's bad. They will not cancel out because it's the same error which we did in multiple models. But this means that the covariance of them will be high or higher, right? Because it means that both of them did the prediction on the same side. However, if they are uncorrelated, we have a good chance of this of these errors to be canceling out each other. So mathematically, let's say that we have the random variables, these will be the errors, right? Let's say they are uncorrelated. And just for simplicity, assume they are identically distributed, just that we can write the result in a nice and clear way, but it's not required for actually improving the performance, right? So what we are interested in is what the variance looks like. So the variance of the average of the random variables, and because if they are uncorrelated, if the models don't make the errors on the same examples, but if they make errors on different examples, like that's what it means specifically in this case, then we know that the variance will simplify just to the cases where this I equals to j, right? Because if I is not equal to j, then the covariances are zero. That's what the uncorrelated means. And if they are the same, then it's just sum of the covariances of the random variables with itself, which we know is a variance. So in this case, we know that the variance of this sum is the sum of the variances. And now the variance of some constant time random variable, that's this constant squared times the variance, right? Because this constant will can be taken out of every random variable occurrence in the definition of the variance. However, there is this square inside, right? So whenever we are taking the constant out, the square needs to be used as well. And now we have the 1 over n squared of the sum of the variances. So if they are identically distributed, they are all have the same variance. It's just for make the notation easier. We get that the variance is the 1 over n of the original variance. So it will go to zero, right? Which means the errors will be canceling out each other. More and more models we have if the errors are uncorrelated. So if the models do the errors differently on different examples, then this will happen. So how to actually come up with models which will have uncorrelated errors? For MLPs, for nonlinear models, it is actually quite simple. Because when we are optimizing an MLP, we are trying to find a minimum in the very large landscape of the loss function. If you visualize the loss function in the d-dimensional space, where d is the number of parameters of the model, then we are searching for a minimum there. And because of the non-linearity of the model, the loss probably looks quite complicated. There are a lot of local minima there. So whenever we are optimizing a model, depending on the initial choice of weights, it will get somehow, the SGD will somehow descend in this space of the loss function. But the models will probably, if you train them using different initialization, they will end up in different places of this loss function. So the errors they produce, they are usually pretty uncorrelated, even if they have very similar accuracy. So empirically, we actually don't need to do anything for MLPs. We just train some number of them. However, this was all caused by the fact that the loss landscape is quite tricky for the nonlinear models, and there are a lot of local optima, so the optimization will be different for each of the models. If instead we have models which have a single local optimum, then this approach of different random initializations will not work. And there are a lot of models like this, the logistic regression, the linear regression, SVM, all of those, they have just one local optimum that's also the global optimum, right? People actually like this about the model, that you know that the SGD converges to the optimum result. However, then different initialization plays much less important role in the optimization. So for such models, we can use a different approach, and this approach is called begging. We will see it applied at the end of today's lecture. And the begging, that doesn't mean we'll be stuffing the models into some bag or something. This is just a shorthand for bootstrap aggregation. So how does it work? Instead of randomly choosing the initialization, we randomize the training data. Of course, we cannot just change the data themselves, that if there is an English sentence on input, how are you going to change it randomly? But what we will do is we will create the data set by the so-called bootstrapping. We assume generally that the data are generated from the data generating distribution. We don't know the underlying distribution, but we can actually estimate it using the empirical data generating distribution, right? We know that if we want to sample one training example, we could just sample uniformly from the training data, right? And this example in expectation has the properties of all the examples in expectation. So we could use this and generate a data set of n examples, which will have the same size as the original training data, right? So we will sample from the data with replacement, right? So I don't know, first we roll a die and then we say, okay, example number 3, you are going to be in my data set. Then we roll a die and say, example number 5, you are going to be in my data set. And then we roll a die and then say, ah, example number 3, you are already there once, but doesn't matter. You'll also be a part of my data, right? So this time you can generate a data set of the same size as the original data set, but with some of the elements repeated. And in expectation, this data set has the same properties as the original data set. It will generate it from the same distribution, but there are some repeats there. And this is the randomization, right? So we created a data set of the same size, but different data sets depending on how we randomly choose the values. And then we can use these different data sets to train the individual models. Now, these different data sets, they can easily have different local global optimas, right? They can, because they only contain some subset of features, they can easily make, or their optimum might solve a bit different task. On average, it's the correct one, but maybe the found features or the found rules will be different. There is an illustration of this example. Let's say that we have got the original data set, which contains 9, 6, and 8. So in the first resample, let's say that 9 is not there. So we just have 8 and 6 is. So whenever you look at this top circle, this top circle is present only in the 8s. Right? So from this data set, we might infer that whenever we see a small circle in the top half of the data, it will just be 8. Right, it's not true in the original data set because there is also 9 here. However, it's true with these set of data. And similar for the second data set where there are no 6s, once again, whenever you look in the lower half, the only digit with the small circle is just 8. So we might have a different rule saying, oh, I'm seeing the small circle in the bottom of the data. Then it's definitely an 8. Right, so if we trained models on these three data sets, they would do different things. But because they are all generated from the same data generating distribution, then on average, they should be fine. So when we combine them together with averaging or unsampling, then they should still do the same thing as the model which we search for. Yep. So that was our talking about model combination. Are there any questions? Would you like to ask something? No questions. So let me get to the main topic of the today's lecture, which are the decision trees. The decision trees are a machine learning model, which is quite old, like 4 decades. And how do the decision trees work? They generally, in a sense, you can understand them as to be the combination of several models, but not in a sense that each model can independently do the predictions and then you combine them. But instead, imagine that you have got this space, this feature space of all the input examples. So the idea of the decision trees is to partition it, split it into some smaller spaces, some subspaces, and then solve the machine learning task in each of these subspaces independently. And there are actually many implementations of decision trees. We will focus on the classification and regression trees called CARP. But there are other versions and variants. Some of them were also commercial. Some of them were some very old open source implementation and so on and so on. But we are using these CARP trees. They are the ones who are also implemented in scikit-learn. So as I said, the main idea is to actually split the input space into some subspaces. So how it might look like. So the first split, let's say that we have got the feature space in two dimensions, right? We have got x1 and x2. So the first split might be looking at the x1 feature. And then if it's larger than some threshold theta one, then this is the right space where we will solve the problem recursively. And here on the left side, there is this case where this feature has smaller value. And because we solve everything separately, then we might just do the same thing in the subtrees, right? So here, once again, we have this left part of the space, and we might once again split it. So this time using, for example, x2 feature and the threshold theta 2. So that's this one, right? And then this A region just corresponds to this one, and this node B corresponds to this region in the space, and so on and so on. So in these CARP trees, we only use one feature in each of the nodes, right? So whenever we are splitting, according to one feature and one threshold, right? You can imagine cases where these nodes would contain hyperplanes and separate using hyperplanes and so on and so on. But we will consider the simple case of actually just separating one feature with one threshold. First, let's talk about the regression trees. Right, so assume that we want to solve regression and we get the data set on the input. It has got 10 examples, we have got some targets and there are real values. And generally constructing an optimal decision tree is very difficult. Well, it is at least NP heavy. To see this, if you would like to create, for example, a tree which will classify, I don't know, a large formula or something, which it will classify clauses, then if we aim for zero training error, that means that we need to classify all clauses, and it will probably be a way how to actually convert this into some satisfiability problem. Right, like there are a lot of trees, and their like error on the training data can differ wildly. So it will be not feasible to actually come up with the optimum tree. So instead, we will construct the so-called decision tree by just greedy algorithm. Right, we will adding nodes to the tree, and we will never allow ourselves to go back. So once we add a node, it will be there in the tree until we finish. So at the beginning, the tree is really just a single node. Whenever we have a leaf, we will denote it theta. Then the I theta will be a set of training examples which corresponds to this node, right? Each node corresponds to region in the input space. So naturally, there is some set of the training examples which are in this corresponding region. So whenever we are doing a prediction in a leaf, then we don't do any further splitting or something. Instead, we just predict a value. So if you imagine that we are somewhere deep, there is a node here, a leaf node, then we will just look at all the training examples, which corresponds to this region, which belong to this node, and we will just compute the average of the targets of the examples, right? That's what the prediction will look like. So each leaf will contain a value, which is just the average of the numbers. And now, in order to construct a tree, we will need something like a loss function, right? You will need something that will measure how well can our tree actually work for the training data. However, it's not called loss in this context. It's usually called a criterion. So we will have a criterion which for each leaf will tell us how uniform or homogeneous the data in this node are. So you can somehow visualize it as a loss, right? So zero will mean great, there is no error, which means the data are like completely uniform, completely homogeneous, that they are just they just have the same target value, for example. And the larger it will be, the larger difference, the larger, I don't know, error we have for the examples in this leaf. Yep. So for example, in the case of the regression, what we will use as the criterion will be the sum of square errors. We look at all the instances which belong to this node and compute the square of the distance of this target and the predicted value which we have computed here. This is nearly the mean square error which you would expect maybe, but know that we are not computing the average here. So we are not averaging by the size of the data, right? Instead, it's just sum. And that's an important thing because if you have multiple nodes in the decision tree, there can be a different number of training examples which correspond to these leaves, right? So when we would use just the mean error, then we wouldn't take in account the fact that there are much larger number of examples, for example, here on the left and on the right. Therefore, we instead use the criterion as the sum of all the examples, which also includes the fact that some of these leaves actually corresponds to a larger number of training examples. Now, when we have the criterion, what we will want to do is we will want to find a tree which has the minimal criterion value. However, as I said, there are exponentially many trees, and searching them one by one is no good, and we cannot. So we will just use a greedy algorithm, and the greedy algorithm will say, okay, let's split a node in such a way that the criterion changes decreases the most, right? And well, what I mean when I say the criterion decreases, well, let's say that we had this node T. Now we are splitting it into T left and T right. And what we want is the criterion of the original node minus the criterion of these two new leaves is the largest, right? So the decrease is the decrease in the criterion is the largest possible. So usually it's formulated from the other way around when we look at the criterion of the left and the right subtree. And then we subtract the original criterion, the criterion of the original node, then we want this to be the smallest. Now, because we cannot do this in some optimum way, we will do it greedily. So usually we will just take a value of some node and we will split it by this rule. When I say split, what I mean is I mean trying all possible features, right? There are D features, so let's try all of them. And for each feature, I will try each splitting point. Right, so it makes sense to actually try the splitting points which are just in between the values in the training data. Right, if we have got some feature xi and it has got some values, I don't know, ai1, ai2, ai3, and so on, then what makes sense to use as the splitting points? Well, the values which are exactly like in between them if these are sorted. Right, so if we want to find the split, we can find actually the best split for a single node by iterating through all features and all values which will make the prediction differ. We could, in theory, just repeat this splitting until every single example has its own leaf. From this point of view, this can be considered to be a non-parametric model because we can grow it large enough so that each example might have its own specific path through the node, through the tree. However, such a tree would not generalize well, right? Probably, because it has got rules, each specific for one training example. So in a sense, you can say it's doing some kind of a one KNN search, right? Because we have one set of rules for each of the training examples. However, we are by no means searching for the nearest example or something, right? We are just going through the decisions and they will just move us somewhere in the tree, but it can easily happen that the rules which the tree devises are very specific to the training examples and do not generalize to the training data. So in a sense, we will need to probably do some heuristics. In the parametric case, we use the capacity to to use it for regularization, right? We use smaller models, and by the fact that the models were smaller, they had to choose some smaller number of rules, and then it disallowed them to actually generate, it disallowed them to create two specific rules, and instead they had to come up with rules which were applicable to some larger number of training examples. Here, we also might do the same and somehow limit the capacity. So by default, the model doesn't have any capacity defined, so we can create some constraints. There are many possible constraints, but the, I would say, most commonly used three ones are the following. Most importantly, we can limit the depth of the tree. So we can say the depth of the tree is just 4, and whenever 1, 2, 3, 4, whenever we have four parents, then this must be a leaf, and we cannot split it anymore. Right? This means we also have the limit on the number of nodes in the tree, the exponential with the depth, and this makes the model in a sense parametric because we know that each tree will have at most some fixed number of parameters. So this is a very frequently used constraint. We could also say that we don't want to split a node if it contains too little training examples. For example, we might say that once there are two training examples belonging to a single leaf, then we will not split it anymore because then it will create rules which are applicable only to single training intents, and that might be too much. All right. And the other possibility to limit the capacity might be not to specify the maximum depth, but instead maximum number of nodes in the tree. So either by the maximum number of leaf nodes or internal nodes, whatever, these are exchangeable somehow. So these are the most commonly used ways how to limit the capacity of the decision tree. Now, depending on which of these did we use, we will choose our construction algorithm. Specifically, if this maximum number of leaf nodes is not limited, it's unconstrained, then we can use a very simple approach by usually using the depth first method and splitting every node until it makes sense, right? So if, for example, we have the maximum depth limit and we have a node which is not on the last layer of nodes, we can just split it. So we can split the nodes independently in this case, right? Whenever we see a node, we just check whether it fulfills these criteria, and if it does, we perform the best split. So we iterate through the features, through the values, choose the one where the total criterion will decrease the most. However, if we instead limit the maximum number of nodes, we cannot just split the nodes independently, right? Because like once we, I don't know, split these into four, then at this point, we cannot just decide that we are going to split this node. Instead, if we want to minimize the criterion, what we might want to do is we might want to actually check all four of these and then split such a node where the criterion will decrease the most. So maybe, I don't know, let me split this one. And then once again, we are actually considering these leaves, right? And we might find out where which of those would actually decrease the criterion the most and then split in this order. Right, so it will be instead some kind of a best first search where we would, or a priority based search where we would split the node where the criterion will decrease the most, and we will do this for the fixed number of times. So that's also a useful way how to specify the capacity of the model. It's a bit more technical and it's a bit more difficult to do it than just limiting the depth. However, if we have the fixed number of nodes which we want to be there in the tree, then this should give us a reasonably good solution. So we have an algorithm. We are minimizing the criterion. We have some regularization, just like the way how to limit the capacity of the model. I said that we are building the tree greedily, so that we never actually remove nodes. However, this is definitely a suboptimal solution, but it's the one which is efficient, so we are using it. However, once we have finished building the tree, we might want to revisit the decisions of actually splitting the nodes. So sometimes this phase called pruning also takes place. And during pruning, we may decide that some of the nodes were actually not good enough to be split. So we decrease the criterion somehow, but probably it wasn't enough. Such a pruning thing could first improve generalization. So maybe doing some splits is not really necessary and it will add some additional variance in the model prediction. And also it can be used to compress the model, all right? So if we wanted the model to fit on disk or some specific place, then of course this pruning is like a way of compression where we just throw away parts of the model and we do it by throwing away the parts which didn't help that much. As you can imagine, there are huge volumes of ways how you could do the pruning. So just for your idea of how this could look, I will describe the one which is being implemented in scikit-learn, and it's called minimal cost complexity pruning. And the idea is to decrease or to prune the nodes where the criterion won't increase much, right? They do something, but we don't think it's actually good enough. But we will not look just at the criterion, but also that's what they mean by saying cost, but also at the complexity, right? So if it looks like this, we have like one node and there is like an extremely large subtree, or we only have two sons all the time, two children all the time. So if there is an extremely large structure, and it makes to decrease the criterion by some constant. And then we have this case, and this also make the decrease the criterion by the same constant, then it's probably better to just drop this whole subtree because it's larger, right? Given that it used so many nodes, it probably should have decreased the criterion much more substantially than this. So these two measures, like the criterion decrease and the complexity, are combined in this pruning approach. And so what we will do, we will measure how much the criterion decreased for a node, but we will not just mean it as a number of by the absolute number by which it decreased, but we will want to know how it decreased considering the number of leaves which we actually have. Right, so we will want to get a number which will tell us, okay, the cost decreases this much times the number of leaves, right? That's the complexity part. So technically, we will define the like cost complexity criterion for a leaf by taking the original one and increasing alpha, right? So if one constant for every node, and then if we have a subtree rooted at t, then the criterion of this subtree is the cost complexity criterion of the leaves, which means the original criterion plus alpha times the number of leaves, right? So this is where this dependence on the complexity on the number of leaves actually come up. Know that when we were splitting, then the criterion of the children of the node which we split are usually less or equal to the original criterion, at least for this sum of squares error, which we use, right? Then whenever we split the node, then these criteria of the two children are less or equal to the original one. That means what we can do is we can actually find out some value of alpha, where this cost complexity criterion would be the same independently on whether we split the node or didn't. All these are the official definitions from the algorithm, and they are a bit complex, right? So what this does is it looks at the criterion of the original node minus the criterion of all the leaves, right? So this is the criterion which we would get if we didn't split the node, and this is the whole subtree which was created by splitting the node. And we divide this decrease by the number of leaves minus one. So it tells us the value of alpha such that this cost complexity criterion would be the same independently on whether we did split or did not split the node. So it says, this alpha tells us how much will the criterion decrease as a function of the number of leaves. Now, this will tell us like how efficient or good the individual nodes are. Right? The node which has the smallest value of alpha, then that's the one which, in a sense, decreases the criteria the least. Right? So if we want to prune, we should probably prune the nodes in the order of increasing alphas, right? From the one which altogether increased the criterion, the least one, when taking the complexity into account, right? And then we can just prune for some number of times. So we say, okay, I want to prune, I don't know, 10% of nodes, which are the worst from this kind of view, and then you just prune them, right? So that's the pruning, and what the pruning does, in addition to the criterion, is that it also includes this complexity view, right? So it somehow includes the fact that whenever we splitted this node, it resulted in these many children. So we hope that it was actually worth it, and if it's not, we just cut it, prune it, and that's it. So that's a heuristic pruning algorithm. All of this sounds, or at least sounded to me at the beginning, to be very arbitrary. Like we are doing it greedily, that kind of makes sense. We are minimizing some kind of error, that kind of makes sense. We want to limit the capacity, so why not? There are, of course, ways, many ways how to do it, so why not limiting the depth or the number of nodes? With the pruning, it seems this is like super arbitrary, like there are many ways how we could evaluate it. So this is the simple one where we don't take into account not just the criterion, but also the complexity, so the number of the size of the subtree. However, even if there are many arbitrary choices, actually there exists a model which builds up on the decision trees, which is quite useful and successful in practice. That's the so-called gradient boosted decision tree. That's something what we will talk about on the next lecture. And if you consider like an area of like there are places where people like compete in machine learning, very much similar to what we do in the assignments, right? So you can somebody can say, okay, I have a data set, I would like people to try to find the best solution for the data set. So you give them some time, they submit the models, you evaluate them on the training data, and then somebody wins and maybe get some money or some good feeling. And the two models which are the most popular in the best solutions are deep neural networks, and the second model are these gradient boosted decision trees. So even if there are some arbitrary decisions, they will still give rise to a very strong model. Actually, in the gradient boosted decision trees, this is not really being used. The maximum tree depth is used as a regularization. So in a sense, not much of arbitrary choices, but I kind of think it makes sense to know something about these things, but we will not be even implementing pruning in the assignments because I think it's too arbitrary that it would be worth to actually know the details. Yep. So now, what about the classification? All right. Until now, we were performing a regression where the criterion was kind of obvious. And so, in a classification, each node will predict one of the classes, right? So in the regression, each node predicted the target. We are also predicting the target, but really just as the class into which we classify all the examples which belong to this node. to define the criterions, let us denote the value ptk to be the probability of the class k of all the examples which belong to the node t. Right, so what I mean is ptk is estimated by looking at the like number of training examples belonging to this node, such that the class or the target of this example is equal to k, right? This is divided by the size of the examples. So it's the categorical distribution of classes of examples belonging to this node. And we will, or in practice, usually two different criteria are being used. The first one is Gini index. So in Gini index, what we do is we compute the variance of, or what we do is for each class, we compute ptk times 1 minus ptk, and this is actually the variance of the categorical distribution. However, it's multiplied by the size of the set, right? So the variance would not depend on the size. So this is variance multiplied by the number of examples. This is, in a sense, similar, analogous to what we did in the regression. We also computed the variance there, right? But not divided by the number of examples. So that's the same thing in here. Or we could use the entropy criterion, which will measure not the variance of the categorical distribution, but instead the entropy of the distribution in the nodes. And once again, multiplied by the number of nodes. Right? We talked about that these are not losses. They are actually weighted losses by the number of examples. So these seemed kind of arbitrary. So let's see where they actually come from, right? So first, let's show that the, in the binary case, the Gini index is actually a solution to the mean square error, well, formally square error, but it would be the same solution as to the mean square error. Right, so we will derive this criterion from trying to minimize some kind of a square error. So let's denote the number of examples with class 0 as nt0 and the number of examples with class 1 as nt1. And let the probability of the target value 1, pt, be just the average or the probability, the estimated probability of this happening. Now assume or consider that we want to minimize this square loss. So for each example, we will compute the error as the square of the difference between the target and the probability, some probability. So this is loss for a given prediction probability. First, we can show that the value which minimizes this loss is actually exactly pt, right? That if we want to minimize the square error, then the best thing what we can do is actually to predict the average of the targets, right? That kind of makes sense, but it really holds mathematics. If we want to do it, we just compute the derivative. The derivative of that is the sum over all I of 2 times p minus ti, right? We say that it, we set it to 0. So we can, and then we can rewrite by saying that sum over I of p should be sum of I over of the targets. So the probability should be the sum of the targets divided by the number of examples, which is exactly our definition of PT. So that's the first thing. So this loss is being minimized by this value. Now, what does this value actually is? Right, what the value of this loss actually is? Well, we can just substitute this PT into the definition, right? This sum goes over two classes. So let's compute it as the two products. The first one for all the examples which have class zero, and the second for the examples which have class one. For the examples which have class zero, the value here is PT minus zero squared, and for the one which have target one is PT minus one squared. Now let's substitute the definition of PT in the equation. So this PT is defined as the number of examples with class one divided by the number of all examples, and we can compute all examples by computing the examples of class zero and one, right? So this is just this PT. This one minus PT, that's the probability of the opposite class, right? It's the probability of the class zero. So we can expand the one minus PT squared as this part, right? Number of examples for class zero divided by the number of all examples. We can actually write this as the this we can take out nt0 plus nt1 from both the numerator and the denominator. Right, when we take nt0 plus nt1 from the top, what we get is we get that it's nt0 plus nt1 times nt0 nt1. And we can cancel out these vectors. And now we will reintroduce the probabilities there once again. So let me choose different colors. This one, that's just pt1, right? That's the probability here, this one. This one, the probability of one minus PT1. However, we use the denominator twice, so we actually need to reintroduce another one here for this to be true. And this denominator is just the number of examples, right? So what we get is that the value of the minimum value of this square error loss is exactly the Gini index. Right, so we can look at this as the smallest loss which we would get if we predicted the optimum value in the leaf. And we can do the same for the entropy, and then the entropy can be proven to actually minimize the negative log likelihood loss. Right, so now we are kind of back. That's what we did all the time. We used the maximum likelihood estimation to minimize the negative log likelihood error. And so the good thing is we are still doing it here. I just said that it's true, so maybe I should convince you also by showing you why it's the case. So let's say NTC to be the number of examples with class C, which belong to the node at hand. And let's denote this PTC to be the categorical distribution of the classes corresponding, or classes of the examples corresponding to this node. Right, so this is the generalization of what we did here, but here we really go for all the classes at the same time. The loss which we consider is this negative log likelihood. Right, so for each training example, we look at the probability being predicted by the model for the correct target. First, we will minimize this loss. So what we want to do is we want to find the distribution such that this LP is minimal. Once again, we can just do the usual thing, compute the derivative with respect to P and setting it to zero. However, this time it's a constraint optimization actually, because the found probabilities, found numbers must be a distribution, right? So if you want to minimize it, we want to minimize the corresponding Lagrangian. So just like a minor exercise, let's consider how it would go. So our Lagrangian is the thing which we want to minimize, the negative log likelihood, plus lambda times the sum over C of PC minus one. Now let's compute the derivative with respect to one of these probabilities. So let's say a PC. So here, what we get, there is a sum with probabilities of various classes. So when we are computing the derivative with respect to PC, then what we care about is the elements of the sum for the class C. There are this many of them, PTC, and the derivative for them looks like one minus one over P of this class C. Right, and then we also need to compute the derivative of the right side, and that's just lambda times one, right? Because only one of these p's is the one which you compute the derivative for, and we get one for the corresponding one and zero for all the others. But now we can rearrange this to show that the pc should be equal to a lambda times the number of training examples of class C. So what we got is that the PC should be proportional to the number of examples with class C. And because we want this to be distribution, we might compute the final value of lambda, but we can just look at it and we will see that it will be exactly this one. Right, because if the lambda has the value of one over the number of the training examples, then all these this constraint would be fulfilled. We would really get a distribution, right? So this is just a very small exercise in working with Lagrangians again. And now let's look at what the value of this loss actually will be for the optimum one, the smallest one. So it will be the sum of the negative log likelihood. And that's we will compute this sum as going through the classes. There are as many examples of the class as NTC, and the probability is logarithm of this PTC, right? That's what we estimated here. And we just rearrange stuff so that we really introduce the entropy. This is nearly the entropy, right? They just need to be the probability. So if this would be a probability, we would need to multiply by the number of examples, which means the criterion is the number of examples times the entropy, which is exactly what we have here. So we have criteria such as which you would expect, kind of, especially the entropy one. And that's it. So these are the decision trees. Are there any questions regarding the decision trees? Nope. So we have last 4 minutes or so, which we will use on extending the decision trees to random forests. Decision trees have very good properties. They are interpretable. You know exactly why they are deciding what they do, right? That's the big good quality. They are interpretable. You know what's happening. You know what the system actually learned. But the problem is that they sometimes don't work that well. If you are trying to solving a difficult task, then just using one decision tree will probably not be enough. However, we might use introduction about the model combination, and actually created not just one tree, but actually a lot of trees. And the collection of this, like an ensemble of the decision trees, is usually called a random forest. So in the random forest, we will get the training data we will train a lot of decision trees, and then during prediction time, we will combine their predictions by averaging them for the regression and voting, the hard voting in the case of classification. Know that it's usual to create like 100 of the trees or something, really like not just two or three, but dozens or even hundreds. So even if we are just doing hard voting, there are so many models to vote that there will be very little ties, I would say. So the question is how to actually train trees which have uncorrelated errors, right? We need trees which are which will be different enough so that in total their predictions will improve the overall quality. So for that, we will use two improvements or two changes. First is to use begging. So every tree will be trained using a bootstrapped data set. So for each tree, we create a new data set by bootstrapping and then train the tree. But still, this is not enough, because if there are features which are very important, very decisive, then even if you just see the subset of data, then probably these will be chosen by the node splitting. So in the end, the predictions will still be fairly similar, because the important features will probably not be changed much by subsampling the data or bootstrapping the data. So additionally, we also use it's called feature aggregation, but the full name could be a random subset of features, which means that whenever we are splitting a node, we will only consider some subset of features. So for each node separately, we will choose which features we are going to consider. And then we will find the best split only using these subset of features. So first thing, this will make the construction faster, right? Because we don't need to consider all of them, but only some number of them. But the important thing is that if there are some decisive features, then there is a good chance that they might not be used as the first ones in the model. So instead, the model needs to seek for alternative explanations. But it cannot always use one of the features to explain the outcome. It is forced to actually create the answer using the other features as well. So these two altogether create models with larger, which are more uncorrelated with larger variance. However, if we average a lot of them together, then hopefully the ensemble classifier should be better. And in practice, it actually usually is nearly always better than just using one decision tree. Yep. There are also various versions. Whenever you say random forest, you usually think about the ensemble of decision trees plus these two techniques used during training. There are also, for example, trees called extra trees, like extra randomized trees, where you don't try even all the feature values to do the split, right? Whenever you are splitting with some feature, we just considered all the possible values until now, and just tried all the splits. Right, and in extra trees, you just sample the splits like uniformly from the range of the splits, right? So you do some fixed amount of them, so you even have larger variants. So you need a collection of those so that they will work nicely together. But once again, you can train a bit faster, which might be useful. Well, in any case, you will see various birds. Like this, and I'm introducing the extra trees because they are used in scikit, so you will see them among the ensemble classifiers as well. Okay, so now we got to the end of the lecture. So thank you very much for your attention. I hope it worked, even with me wandering around. I'm looking forward to hear how the sound looks like. tomorrow there will be this optional Q&A, so maybe we will see each other there, or we will see each other on the Wednesday's practicals when we will talk about new assignments. And if not, then hopefully next Monday. So I wish you a good week. Enjoy. And if you still have some further questions, then don't hesitate to ask me. But if you are going, then bye-bye. Thanks for attention.